time. He appointed Alicia Fontenot to run NOLA until he gets back. Once things are settled, he wants you to go to the European court and take over as the Dark Queen. Beast shook head in human way, side to side, trying to think like Jane. Leo Head is not gone. Saw Leo Head fly into air. Thought about Arcanciel and Crystal, about Soul hiding on island. Time walkers. Better time walkers than Jane. Eli smiled tiny smile. Molly's okay. So is her baby. You staying here for a while? Beast nodded once. Stupid human move. There's food in the house. Call when you want to come home. Home. To Jane Den. With Eli and Alex. With Jane sick and dying. Beast snorted softly. Eli walked away. I woke up under the low tree, human-shaped, naked. The sun was a scarlet wash of color in the west. There was a bag that looked waterproof hanging in the limbs of the tree just above me. I reached up and touched it. The bag was dry. The sand beneath me was dry. The air was cold and damp, blustery. But the sky was bright, the cerulean blue of sunset with a single star and a sliver of moon half hidden in distant clouds. The island felt empty. The house had no lights. Everywhere was dark, silent, deserted. I was alone. I rolled carefully to my feet and untied the bag. Found inside a pair of jeans wrapped around undies and a bra, three t-shirts for layering and a warm jacket. Running shoes beneath them with a pair of wool socks stuffed into the toes. On the bottom was a vamp killer and Lubraluck and the glob. Memories came hard and fast. Del dying, Katie in danger of dying, so many others. My memory of Leo's head flying, flying, flying over and over, and time bending, bubbling, twisting, changing reality, changing every moment of the possible present. I blinked the images away, only to see them again on the back of my lids. I had a feeling I would see them forever. Yet atop that was the memory of Eli, telling Beast that Leo might still live. That he was poisoned by an Arcanciel bite. Things not in my timeline. I shivered hard in the cold wind, studied Lubraluck. I had killed the Emperor. I was now the Dark Queen of the Vamps, de facto ruler of the Fangheads. This sucks, I said to the empty beach. I pulled on my clothes, braided my hair in a sloppy braid, picked up the crown, slid it over one arm, took the vamp killer and the glob, and trudged to the house. There were no lounge chairs dotting the shore, no fire pit, no people. The island was silent. I was marooned on a deserted island? That would be a kicker. If I was stranded here. So much for being the queen of the suckheads. I climbed the steps to the house and found the front door unlocked. I kicked the sand off my shoes and went inside. The windows were shuttered closed, leaving the house dark inside. The furniture was cocooned under white sheets. The house sounded big and hollow and empty. It even smelled empty. Beast. How long did you keep me asleep? My voice echoed in the empty rooms. We grieved, she thought at me, which was sort of an answer. My stomach growled. I made my way to the kitchen, opened the refrigerator. The light inside came on, proving that the solar panels on the roof three stories above were still working, which meant plumbing. A shower would be nice. The shelves inside the refrigerator were full of food and beer and wine. Boone's Farm Fuzzy Navel. I chuckled and pulled the note off the bottle in front. It read simply, I love you. Come home. Bruiser was fine. That was good. I stuffed the note in my bra next to my heart. I removed the bottle and opened it, drank it down. It tasted fantastic. Beyond fantastic. I opened another, wishing for once that I could get roaring drunk. Skinwalker metabolism wasn't agreeable to a good roaring drunk. Brains are better, Beast thought at me. Gack, I said aloud, my stomach rumbling. Pig is good, though. I opened the freezer. The pig had been fully pulled and placed in zippered gallon-sized plastic bags, 5 of them, frozen hard. I stuck one under the kitchen faucet and let water run over it until it was soft enough to remove the meat from the plastic, and then nuked the gallon of meat until it was hot. While it thawed and heated, I checked the food in the fridge, knowing the smell would tell me how long I had been alone on the island. The beanie weenies didn't smell perfect, but I pulled them out and stuck them in the microwave when the pork was hot, dumped the pig into the soup tureen on the kitchen island. That was when I spotted the card on the Carrera marble. Heavy cardstock, folded over, red writing on white paper. It was the red of one of my lipsticks. Blood red. Not so favorite anymore. The note was arranged like an upside-down pyramid. It read, "Chérie, I done left you the rest of that pig you like so much. The kid done left you a satellite phone. Eat. Call home. We come get you. Dion." I spotted the phone on the island, too. Didn't pick it up. While the beans heated, I carried the tureen around, snacking, and made a quick tour of the house. Someone had stripped the wet wallboard tape from the walls, reapplied fresh. There was no luggage left, no sign of blood on the floors. When the microwave dinged, I brought the bottle of Boone's Farm and the food to the front porch and sat down in the dark. Night had fallen fully. The surf sounded lazy and languid and soothing. I ate and drank, watching the tide roll in. When my belly was full, I put the leftovers in the fridge and took a hot shower. The house was cold, but someone had left an electric blanket on the bed I had used, along with a set of sheets in my luggage. The blanket smelled like Molly. Eli had said that she was okay, too. I pulled on sweats and the wool socks that had come with the shoes and wrapped myself in the blanket. I fell on my bunk and let sleep pull me under. I woke at dawn, ate pig, drank wine. I was halfway through the bottle when I saw a flash of a head flying through the air. Leo's head. Memory. Intense as reality. Stark. Electric. I blinked. Sobbed once, hard and harsh and dry. Eyes burning. Leo was in a blood box. He might not be true dead. Or not exactly true dead. A second image slammed into me. Titus's head in my hand, then drop into the sand. I'd killed him. It was what I did. I killed people. Beings. Sentient creatures. But I should have killed Titus the moment he walked up to the house on the beach, surrounded by his people. I should have drawn the Moogle blade and taken his head right then. Shoulda, coulda, woulda. Hadn't. I finished the bottle. There were more. Bruiser had left me 12, an entire case. The wine sat heavy on my stomach. Queasy. So I drank more. My second morning on the island in Jane form, I crawled from bed and walked naked down to the beach to swim. The air was warmer, 80s, but the water was cold when I dove in and swam deep, halfway hoping I'd be eaten by a shark. I wasn't that lucky. When exhaustion claimed me, I crawled up the shore and lay in the sun on the sand, naked, alone. When the sun threatened to burn even my golden-toned skin, I rinsed off in the outside shower and went in search of something other than pig. I found a baked fish in the freezer, next to a plastic container that was marked with the words, rice pudding. I microwaved them both. Ate the entire fish, which had Dion's touch on it, lemon and herbs, and the whole container of rice pudding, which tasted like coconut and rice and dates and cranberries. They shouldn't have tasted good together, but they did. I drank another bottle of wine, deciding that I'd drink a bottle per day from now on, to mark off the days as human. But I didn't feel so well, and I was tired. Grief could make a person tired. Right? Right. Days passed. A helo flew over once and I waved it off. It left. I was okay. I just needed privacy. But instead of feeling better, I was feeling worse. A lot worse. After the last bottle of wine, I knew it was time to call for extraction. I'd been walking on the beach at sunset, the empty bottle in my hand, swinging. I'd tried singing, quit when my own ears protested. I was a mile along the beach, heading back to the house, when the sickening feeling hit me. A wrench and nausea that tossed me to my knees, retching. I vomited up everything I'd eaten for dinner, hard and nasty, onto the sand. It was full of blood. I used to throw up blood when I bubbled time, but it had been days, weeks. Beast, what's happening? Jean is sick. Jean may be dying. Relief zipped through me like lightning. I wouldn't have to keep on. I thought about being sick. It's the snake in the center of all things, isn't it? Jean is broken. Jean has darkness growing in her. Beast sent me a vision of my insides. I have cancer, I thought wonderingly. Jean is dying. Jean has broken time, and time has broken Jean. Well, how about that? The helo landed on the beach 2 hours after dawn. I climbed on and accepted the ear protectors, put them on and strapped myself in, gave the pilot a thumbs up and settled back to not enjoy the ride. I was weak and nauseous, pretended to be fine. Eli met me at the landing site, took one look at my face and grasped the bag I carried, led the way to the armored SUV, headed to HQ, which was where I told him to go. We rode in silence, his battle face on, giving nothing away. Midway there, he said, "Babe, don't," I said. "Please don't." He nodded and threaded through traffic, parked in front of HQ. "I'll be just a minute," I said. "I'll wait for you." The way he said it held overtones of, "I'll wait for you forever no matter what." I didn't reply to the tone. I didn't have forever. I opened the bag that had been waiting for me on the back seat and removed the small weapon, stuck it in the waistband at my spine, just in case. Picked up the vamp killer and strapped it to my thigh. Stuck the glob in a pocket, also just in case. I shut the door. HQ looked the same as I climbed the steps. The outer doors opened. The inner doors opened. The smell inside was different. No blood, no sex, no scent of fading funeral flowers or parchment. There were vamps here, sleeping, but not in great numbers and not the ones from before. Instead, there was a long line of humans waiting. Rassler limped toward me, his hands out, a welcoming smile on his face. I held up my hand to stop him. "Not now," I said softly. Rassler's face fell and he gave me a truncated nod before stepping back in line. No one frisked me. No one said anything about the weapons on my person. Everything was different. Silently, I took the elevator to the basements, all the way to sub-5. I was armed with a 14-inch silver-plated steel vamp killer with a cross-hatched handle, the glob in my pocket, and a small 32 pistol loaded with silver lead rounds. I didn't need anything else for this. The doors opened. The lighting was low. Brute was sitting at the feet of the Son of Darkness. One of them, anyway. Josie's looked pretty good for a heartless lump of vamp meat. Stinkier, hairier. Brute had been biting him enough. Josie's was halfway to being a werewolf vamp bag of bones. Hiya, Brute. He panted at me, his white coat catching the low lights with an almost ethereal glow. Leo's in a box of blood. He isn't in charge anymore. I pulled the vamp killer, dropped the bag. Okay with you if I finish this? Brute chuffed, tilted his head, tongue lolling. He looked at Josie's, his eyes staring at the vamp's wrists and ankles where he hung suspended on the wall. Brute chuffed what might have been a warning, looked at me, turned his massive head back to Josie's and whined, a simple plaintive note. I walked past the white werewolf and positioned myself. You will not. The words grated out, harsh as stone on stone. I looked at Josie's. He was looking back at me, eyes focused, black pupils and yellow orbs. Sane-ish. As sane as the old ones ever got. Talking, giving orders. Say again. You will not. I live. Forever. Yeah? I reared back, the vamp killer in a two-hand stance. Josie's shackles snapped, shattered, fell away. He surged off the wall spider-fast, pushing, bowing, springing, leaping in explosive force right at me, beneath the vamp killer blade. Time slowed into a battlefield intensity. I saw, smelled, felt, heard the pop of displaced air. Vamp speed on meth, a rupture in reality. And he grabbed me, claws sinking deep. Inside the vamp killer's reach, beast shoved into me, claws bursting from my fingertips, fangs ripping through my jaw. Too late. Too late. The Son of Darkness opened his mouth, unhinged his jaw. I reared back, my claws piercing him, shoving him away. Foolish kit, not defense, must attack, beast thought. A werewolf roared. I jerked to the side, not far enough. The SOD's 5-inch fangs sank deep. But there was no pain. He was healed enough to have vamp saliva. Analgesic, I thought. His magic shot into me, struck at my core and the 5-pointed magic that resided there. My mind flickered on and off. All I could think was, how? And then even that was gone. Josie's sucked deeply at my torn shoulder, moved his head to my throat. My blood felt heated and languid, my muscles softened, my joints relaxed, my arms came up around him. Suddenly I was in my soul home, lying on the damp, cool gray stone staring up at the ceiling, domed overhead. Hale's wings fluttered where they rested, draped down the walls. Beast appeared over me, her golden eyes glowing. She lay atop me, her cat warmth soothing, and then she slid into me, falling through my soul to the place where we were one. And I was back in the basement. Things were happening around me, roars, the ground was shaking, people were screaming. Beast lifted my hand away from Josie's, slid it into my pocket, curled my fingers around the glob. Beast eased my hand out of the twisted cloth and raised my fist. She pressed it into the wound on Josie's shoulder, where my hour claws had pierced him, into his blood. The glob that had a shard of a blood cross and part of the spike of Golgotha woke, blazing hot, attacked. Sudden as a pouncing mountain lion, it gripped Josie's magic, tore it free. Josie's stopped, frozen. The memories of Josie's Santana opened, and I fell into the sensation and person of Josie's, Yusace Bariudas. I saw I felt. I knew. Knew. The moment the two sons of darkness killed their sister and spilled her blood onto the pile of bloody wood, onto their father's dead body, chanted as she died, chanted and spoke words so ancient, even Yosache didn't know the meaning. Knew the moment the betrayer opened his eyes, took his first breath, and attacked. Knew the feel of Iudas Issachar's fangs buried into Josie's own throat. Knew the moment the sons finally trapped their father and chopped him into bits with a stolen Roman sword. Knew the moment they walked the streets of Jerusalem and tasted the first kiss of blood. Knew when they killed. Killed again. Innocent blood so full of life. Then hiding, always running, always going back and back and back again to the pile of bloody broken wood, the pile of the blood cross that had given them this undeath. Fleeing the Christians who sought to kill them, escaping the hell that the Romans brought upon the rebellious city, taking the ones with whom they had shared their gift of undeath. Reaching safety, settling in Rome, later in France, and later still in Spain, traveling the world from Africa to the steppes of what is now Russia and China, drinking from the Khan who would change the world, giving Genghis power and success in return for servitude and safety, and enough humans to satisfy them. For centuries, hundreds, thousands, the power behind the conquest of the world. Then back to Europe and... The memory stopped. I returned to myself. The glob was so hot in my palm that I could smell the flesh there scorching. I blinked. Holding the glob in his blood, I pressed the son of darkness away from me. Hands gripped his head and pulled back. Other fingers gripped his jaw and pulled down. I smelled Eli. He hadn't stayed in the SUV. Of course he hadn't. The fangs of the son of darkness slid from the lower curve of my neck. Beast rolled me over and to my feet. People backed away fast. I picked up the vamp killer I had dropped when I embraced the SOD. I raised the blade and swept it down. And took the head of the son of darkness, Josie's Santana, Yosache Bar Iudas. The son of Judas Iscariot. There was almost no blood. The body quivered, shook. The fingers clenched and opened. I held up the head. Its eyes blinked, focused on me. Huh, I said. The lips moved, though there was no sound. I live, Santana's head said. I considered that. Beast thought at me, vampire head is tasty. I did not want to know how she knew this. I looked over my shoulder. Brute, you hungry? The werewolf stood and patted to me, sniffed at the head of the creator of the vamps. Brute chuffed. Santana's mouth opened in horror, a silent scream. I tossed the head up into the air like a basketball. Brute leaped, caught it in his fangs. When you're done, I indicated the pulsing body on the floor. Be sure to clean up any mess. Brute chuffed again, muted through the hair of his dinner. We don't want anything left to regrow. Brute nodded and dropped the head to his paws. I looked around at the humans who stared at me in fear and horror, as if I was a monster. Which I was. All except Eli, who looked vaguely amused. To the others, I said, go back upstairs. Leave the wolf to his dinner. When he's done, burn the bones and scatter the ashes. They turned and fled. I walked to the elevator, and the doors closed behind Eli and me. My last glimpse of the SOD was Brute eating all the soft tissue of the face, in preparation to ripping off the jaw and eating the brains. I'd been with Beast when she ate skulls and brains. I knew how it was done. Messy, but effective. She sent me an image of Titus's head as she ate it.
Ugh.
The elevator rose to the foyer, the two of us silent, me trying to decide what I needed to do next. There was the Undying Heart in the hands of the Nola Witch Coven, wherever that was. I figured I could leave that to Eli. I left the way I came in, but this time there was only Rassler waiting. I stopped and shook his hand. He hugged me. I hugged back, silent, tears in his eyes. I stepped back and asked, "Del?" Rassler shook his head. "Her mother took her back to the mountains. She buried her there, in the family plot." I blinked away the tears. "Jody, did she ever say yes?" Rassler beamed. "We're planning a June wedding. Congratulations." I hugged him hard, holding him close, so I couldn't see his face. I asked, "Leo?" "Buried in the Pellissier Mausoleum, beneath the new moon, with the blood of his enemies poured upon him, with the potion of blood he created from the Caruso vial. Buried with all honors and glory due to his name." Rassler stopped, breathed in slowly. "He didn't rise with the full moon." My heart clenched, but Leo had given part of himself to me when I tasted his blood. I wondered what would happen if I reached out with my mind, with my skinwalker magic calling to him. "Leo, are you there?" But there was nothing. No answer. Not even a hint of a whisper of a breath of undeath. I shook my head and left HQ, Eli on my heels. I heard the lock clack closed as I got into the car, laid back my head. Eli drove me to my freebie house. My house. My first home ever. I had the deed. I owned it outright. A fierce sense of possession washed over me. Then it rolled away like the surf on the island. I got out of the SUV and went inside. Alex rushed up and hugged me. I hugged him back as if memorizing the way he felt against me, all bone and muscle, and inches taller than when we first met. Eli gestured to him and the kid stepped back. "We'll catch up after dinner," Alex said. "I'm in the middle of security for your new clan home." I nodded and stepped away. Dropping off my gear, I walked around the house looking things over. Eli stood in the middle of the living room, watching. Waiting. He said nothing as I noticed the missing wall and the exposed fireplace. I could smell paint and fresh building materials. I'd asked him once to see if he could find and restore the original fireplaces. This was my answer. While I hid on the island, he found one, uncovered it, and repaired it with a ceramic surround, a bronze facon, and a heavy Victorian-style mantle carved with curlicues and fleur-de-lis, beautifully restored. It was on the small wall between living room and kitchen. I'd never have thought about a fireplace there. I checked out the kitchen to see that we now had a copper farmhouse sink and commercial fridge, things Eli had been wanting. I checked out the laundry, which was unchanged, and followed him up the stairs. He had refinished the bathrooms with sleek quartz countertops and new fixtures and fancy tile. My partner had been busy. I smiled at him to show I liked it. A smile lit up his face and he led me up the new narrow staircase to the third floor. It was amazing. The central space was vaulted and wood-floored, the bedrooms in back, office spaces to make the housing and insurance companies happy, were finished. The bathroom was a tiny cubicle done up in marble and antique ceramic tiles. I finally spoke. "This is gorgeous." Eli nodded, his face full of compassion. "Babe." I held up my hand and shook my head. "But..." I shook my head again. "Edmund?" I asked. "Ed. Leo's heir. The vamp primo of the Dark Queen. Complicated. Just the way Leo wanted it." "In Paris, Elas said, as your emissary, setting up a cabinet, establishing your power, sending out edicts in your name. Good. It'll be easy for him to step in when I abdicate. I walked away and down the stairs. Behind me, I heard Eli talking on his cell, his tone frustrated. I spent the day in my bedroom, moving money around, writing emails and letters, on real paper with a pen. Predominantly, my abdication as emperor of the Eurovamps dated to the coming full moon. Eddie Boy could have it. Sending texts, appointing people to positions of power, choosing two vamps as temporary heirs to the European Mithrins. Grey Gwan as heir, and Catherine as second heir, seemed simple enough. If they didn't abdicate. Granting Ming of Glass status as master of the city in Knoxville. Granting Lincoln Shattuck master of the city of Asheville. This made sure Amy Lynn Brown was safe in Clan Shattuck, protected by her now powerful bloodmaster. Trying to figure out how to ensure that Leo's newest wehrlion cub fosters were safe, but not sure how to do that. I ended up leaving that for Edmund to determine. I also appointed the Youngers as co-heirs of Clan Yellow Rock, gave them money and power to protect Molly and Big Evan and my godchildren. Kit. Beast whispered before falling silent again. All beasts' kits. She had been oddly uncommunicative since I returned to my human form. I didn't know what her relative silence meant, but she wasn't missing. She was still there inside with me, so I was okay with her silence. Rereading the will I had signed months ago, a will that left trusts for my godchildren, for Molly and Evan, for the Youngers, leaving everything else to the heirs of Clan Yellow Rock. I wasn't sure the office of Dark Queen could be passed on, but if it could, it would go to the entire Nola Witch Coven. I left Bruiser all my magical items and Bitsa, the things that held me here and gave me power. And the one thing that spoke to me of freedom, my pan-head bastard Harley. I sent a letter of intent to the B-twins, the Robert brothers, who were the lawyers of the Nola Vamps, to sue Raymond Myshika, the leader of all the wares on Earth, and especially the leader of the African wares, the most politically powerful group. In the letter, I accused Raymond of treachery against Americans on American soil. I told the Roberts to proceed with legal papers in my name, with any charges and grievances they could think of, and asked them to send a copy of the paperwork to whatever legal department in the U.S. government would be most effective at keeping Raymond off U.S. soil. I signed it, the Dark Queen of the Mithrins, and the Blood Master of Clan Yellow Rock of New Orleans. I even signed papers for the house that had once been Russo Clan home. It was big enough to be the clan home of Clan Yellow Rock, the official clan residence, and it was actually two full-sized homes in one, perfect for clan business. And it had a pool. I toured a few more houses online while I was at it, and bought two more. Money wasn't a problem. Not now. Not ever again. I talked to Bruiser on the phone, loving the sound of his voice, loving the fact that he loved me. His last words were, "Ed took the Learjet, so I'm flying commercial. I'll be back from New York on the red eye. Don't wait up. I'll crawl in beside you." I won't wait up. I promised. I checked the news for the last weeks to discover that there had been a number of grisly deaths on the full moon. Homeless men slashed to death with knives, throats slit. The Grindys had been at work, killing people bitten by the rogue wolves, the new fledgling werewolves the rogue pack had created. The news of the insane serial killer had hit the airwaves like a tsunami and then disappeared when the killing stopped. If the dead had been wealthy, the press would still be going nuts over it. But since they were poor and largely unidentified, the press had drifted quickly to other stories. Typical, I thought cynically. As well as I could tell, the rogue pack were all dead, too. I wasn't sure why the Grindys didn't kill all the werewolves and be done with it, rather than letting the Bighorn Pack survive and thrive. Maybe it was the fact that they had a leader, and they didn't spread the were-taint. Maybe something else. While I worked, I packed, quietly, surreptitiously, weeding through the things I now owned. Finding that I ended up with just enough to fit in Bits' saddlebags, which, oddly enough, was mostly just the clothes, boots, and weapons I used to travel with, and a few of the smaller magical trinkets I wanted to keep. An hour before dusk, I walked out of my room and through the house, hearing Alex in the shower, smelling roast in the oven. I eased outside. I was weaponed up, dressed for the road and the cold weather. Riding leathers, boots. I walked across the side porch. Ed's fancy car was gone just like so many things. I loaded Bits's saddlebags, opened the wrought iron side gate with its fleur-de-lis scrollwork at the top, straddled my bike, sat there, staring out through the gate. "You not gonna say anything?" I asked. Laconically, Eli said, "Figured that was your job, since you're the one running away from us." I looked back. My partner was sitting in one of the rusted metal chairs we had picked up in a junk place somewhere, the kind with a frame made of a single length of metal pipe, and that rocked back and forth as the metal gave and returned to normal. But he wasn't rocking. He was dressed in jeans and a zip jacket, boots. He looked good. Best brother I might ever have. "I'll be back." Liar, liar, pants on fire. "I'll be dead," I thought to myself. Didn't say it aloud. "I need some time." He nodded, that minuscule motion that was all Eli. He stood. "You'll need these." He stepped off the porch and walked to me. In his hand were two small white boxes. I opened the first one to see the medicine bag that had once belonged to my father, symbol of the life I had lost, the violence I had found. "Iotis says you should open it." Instead, I closed the box and Eli gave me the other one. In the bottom of the box was a stack of business cards. New. The logo at the top was of a crown stabbed through with two stakes. Below that were two lines. "Jane Yellowrock. Have stakes. Will travel." I smiled slightly and tucked a card into my jacket pocket. The boxes I shoved into the saddlebag on top of my ammo and stakes. I tilted my head up at him. "I love you."
"I love you too, babe."
"Tell Alex." I stopped.
"I'll tell him,"
Eli said softly. I rose up and dropped my weight down, kicking Bits at a life. She spluttered for a while, so I pulled on my helmet, adjusted the fit of the Benelli M4 so it didn't pinch my butt. Looked up at Eli. His eyes were intense, calm, so alive. I smiled. He smiled. A real smile full of joy, of family. I gave Bits of some gas. Pulled along the two-rut drive and out onto the street. Gave her some more gas. And took off for I-59. And the road to home. Epilogue. I stopped several times for gas, for fluids, no food. I couldn't keep anything down. I was getting sick fast. The cancer Beast had told me about was taking over. I could feel hard knots in my abdomen. I just hoped I'd get back to Appalachia in time to shift into her so she could return to her beloved mountains. I wasn't sure we'd ever be able to be Jane again, but Beast could take care of herself. It was well after midnight when I stopped at a Hampton Inn and Suites off of 459, the loop around Birmingham. My butt tired, my body cold and weary. I paid for a room and took a long, hot shower. Dressed in sweats, climbed into bed. Couldn't sleep. Belly hurting, The pain was kicking in. At 3:42, I heard the rotors of a helicopter. Distinctive. Familiar. I lay in the dark, tears in my eyes. I hadn't wanted this. Hadn't wanted to make anyone else hurt. But I'd paid with a credit card. Of course I had. All along the route, cokes, coffee, gas. Hadn't even thought about it. And there was the kid. Probably mad as hell, cussing. Probably drinking energy drinks as he traced my passage north. The knock sounded at my door. I got up, stopped to look at myself in the mirror. I looked like crap. Well, I was dying, so there was that. I opened the door. Bruiser was leaning against the door jamb, dressed the way I'd first seen him the very first time in New Orleans. Dark slacks, dress boots, crisp shirt, dark jacket. "Hiya," I said. Bruiser stared at me as if memorizing my eyes, my mouth. But when he spoke, his voice was without inflection. "Soul visited. She says you're sick. She says you smell like cancer." I took a slow breath, watching him. "I'm dying. I'm guessing I have a few days. 2 weeks at the most." "You're heading back to the mountains. To the estate you bought today. Yesterday," he amended, his face giving nothing away. "You intend to shift to beast and let her live out her natural lifespan?" "Pretty much." "And you didn't think to share that with any of the people who love you?" "I'd thought about it. A lot. But I'd been alone most of my life. I'd figured to end it that way." Not knowing what else to say, I shrugged. Bruiser moved into the room. I let him. Shut the door. Crossed my arms over my chest, knowing I looked defensive. Not able to care. Bruiser sat on the end of my bed, feet planted, legs splayed, hands clasped loosely between them. He looked at me. Silence and time and a weird sensation of space built between us, though neither of us moved. "Do you want to die?" he asked. When I didn't answer, he said, "If you want to die, I'll get on Grégoire's Bell Huey and leave you to your business. But if you want to live, we have options. Well, one option." I frowned at him. "I'm not doing chemo. My RNA and DNA are screwed up. I've seen how fast this stuff is growing, how aggressive it is. And I have a feeling chemo might kill what's left of the healthy cells faster than the cancer." The cancer was growing in a star-shaped pattern, the Vitruvian Man pattern of magic. I pressed my middle, feeling the lower points of the star. Magic cancer. Go me. "Chemo isn't on the list. Onorio magic? Onorio magic kills and tames. My magic can't heal. Not you. Not anyone." I frowned harder. "So what's your plan?" He shook his head. "Do you want to live or not?" Tears spilled over. I nodded, the motion jerky. "Yes, with me." I nodded again. Bruiser's smile appeared, so full of relief and joy that tears prickled at my lids. Gently he said, "Come live with me, and be my love, and we will some new pleasures prove, of golden sands and crystal brooks, with silken lines and silver hooks." When I frowned harder, he laughed and shook his head, got up and opened the door. Outside, leaning against the wall opposite, stood Ionis Firewind. His hair was loose, a silken wave, his body relaxed. "May I enter your house, Aegido?" I nodded. He entered and stood before me, his feet spread, his body rooted. "Where is the box Eli gave you before you left New Orleans? The box with our father's medicine pouch in it." I lifted the box from the dresser and gave it to him. I wouldn't need it anymore. Dead people didn't need mementos of the past. They were themselves mementos of the past. "Do you remember the note that said there was something in it if you ever needed it?" Aya asked.
Anne nodded. Did Eli Younger not tell you to open the pouch?
Anne nodded. I didn't.
And do you remember the story I told about the soldier you stabbed on the Trail of Tears?
Anne nodded again.
Uni Lisi instructed me not to tell you this, unless you needed to know, or if you asked. You didn't ask, but I would have told you, had I known you were sick.
I watched my brother, his face calm, inscrutable as an elder of the Tsalagi.
When you stabbed the soldier, he hit you very hard, enough to break bone, to cause you to bleed great amounts of blood.
He opened the box and removed the medicine bag, handling it so carefully that the dry, rotted edges didn't even dust away.
Uni Lisi put this in your father's medicine bag that day.
Gently, he pulled out a leaf-wrapped something, the leaf cracking and falling to the floor, desiccated into nothing. Inside was a short length of broken bone and three teeth, a canine, an incisor, and one molar. Whole and complete. Child's teeth. I blinked. The memory came back to me, a vision of a fist rising to my face, fast, powerful, violent. The sensation of pain exploding through me, a bone-breaking agony that tore through my jaw as the memory forced its way to the surface. My breathing sped up. Then the memory fell away, leaving a place of darkness where it had been only a moment before, bright and vivid. I didn't speak, staring at the small bit of bone and teeth.
When you attacked the white man on the Trail of Tears, he hit you,
Aya said.
He knocked out your teeth, broke out part of your jaw. Uni Lisi gathered it up and kept it, even after she forced you into the bobcat and sent you into the snow.
His golden eyes glinted at me.
They're your teeth. It's the only way she could think to convince you who you are. Who I am. She said that you'd remember. That you'd know.
I remembered, but I also knew the depths of revenge and treachery. Uncertainly, I asked, You're sure? It's mine.
That is what the Keeper of the Secrets of the Skinwalkers said.
I accepted the small, fractured length of bone and teeth, holding it on my outstretched hand. Holding a memento of the before times. A piece of myself. Bruiser asked,
Do you think there might be enough genetic material?
When I didn't answer, Bruiser said,
Can you use the genes in these teeth to shift into a healed you?
I considered them. I don't know. I'd likely be 5 years old. If there was enough viable genetic material to find a pattern.
Maybe. Or maybe you can merge the DNA with your own. Clean yours up.
I looked at Bruiser and let a small smile onto my face.
Will you try?
He asked.
I have searched for you all my life. I don't want to lose you now.
Yes, I said softly. I'll try. Relief flashed across his face like the sun peeking between storm clouds and quickly gone.
Good. Will you marry me? The Roberts will write up a binding prenuptial agreement to protect your holdings and your status as Dark Queen.
My throat hurt, but I managed wryly. It's immoral. And against the law, even in Alabama, to marry a 5-year-old child.
If you shift into a child, then I'll wait until you grow up. I'll wait as long as it takes.
Aya closed my fingers over the bone and teeth. I can't promise anything, I said, but I'll try to heal my body.
And you will marry me.
I will, but not until we see if this thing works, I said. Bruiser's face fell. I tucked the teeth and bone back into the medicine bag, closed it up in the white box. So what now? I asked them. I'm headed to the mountains, to Robbinsville, North Carolina. I'd planned to shift there and let my beast wander the mountains, and maybe track down Uni Lisi, six-man killer, the evil woman who had set me on this blood path and kill her. Didn't say that.
We have a Bell Huey waiting in the parking lot,
Bruiser said.
Room enough for us three. And the bikes. Mine is in there already, waiting for Bitsa. You can get to the mountains in style. And fast.
I nodded, thinking, feeling the paper of the white box in my fingers, the hope inside.
Hate helicopter,
Beast said. I know, I thought back. But Beast is best hunter. Beast can hunt for a way for me to live. She thought back at me.
The eye-we of Beast is not prey. We can find a trail through dense brush that is Jane's sickness. We can defeat time-walking death.
Yeah, we are. We can. We can do this. Okay, I said. Let's make this happen.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Dark Queen, Book 12 of the Jane Yellowrock series. Written by Faith Hunter. Performed by Christine Vam. Executive producers Steve Feldberg and Mike Charzik. Producer Neil Basic. Copyright 2018 by Faith Hunter. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.